Welcome to New Reality. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the ongoing evolution of a spiritual awakening that's happening on this planet. And to many people at this time, there seems to be an activation of a higher level of consciousness, an awakening, people have called it. And tonight's guest is someone who's been tracking this awakening, who's been very much involved in waking people up, in a sense, to who they really are, to their own spiritual nature. His name is George Boyd, and he has the Mudrashram out in California, and he is an outstanding meditation teacher, and he also does something called spiritual cartography that we will be talking about. I also have on the phone one of his students called Shiloh Jackson, and we'll be making some comments, too, about some of the things he's observed working with George. So, George, thanks for being on New Reality.
Thank you, Alan, for having me.
You know, what was interesting for me when I heard about you is first the levels of meditation that you go to in your work, and people don't really get what meditation really is all about or the purpose of it. It's not just to relax the mind. It's to activate our soul's knowledge, or what we truly know that we've been carrying with us as a spiritual awakening. So can you talk a little bit from that angle about what your work with meditation is about? And then we'll get into some of the other work about spiritual cartography. But tell me about your aspect of meditation.
Well, we teach what's called integral meditation. Now, there are many forms of meditation that you would call a unitive form of meditation, which simply means that they teach one technique. They give you a mantra, they awaken your kundalini, they teach you to watch your breath, and that's all you do. Now, in integral meditation, we incorporate many different techniques because just like when you have a toolbox, you know, you don't use simply hammer to do everything. You have a whole toolbox of tools. So that's what we do in an integral meditation system. We teach you how to awaken the energy of awareness, which is called kundalini. We teach you how to open the spiritual heart, which is a path of nadi yoga. We teach you how to unfold the potentials of your soul using something called the transformational mantra. We teach you how to use your subconscious and superconscious mind more effectively. We teach you how to isolate the principle of consciousness, which is called opening the third eye, and we teach you how to travel in full consciousness through the inner realms, and that's called Raja Yoga. We teach you what initiation is, how the divine light descends upon the soul and unfolds you to the next level, and how this occurs in a balanced way. We talk about Jnana Yoga, which is the yoga of intuition, about getting guidance from your soul. We also talk about Agni Yoga, which is ways of drawing down the light fire, which is within the soul, to do healing and to work with different issues in your life. And finally, we talked about living in harmony with the soul when you're in your normal waking state of consciousness, which is called Dharma Yoga. So our system incorporates all those elements, and those who take the course with us, either in the form of our in-person course, which is called the Mudra Ashram Master Course in Meditation, or our by-mail course, which essentially is the same program called the Accelerated Meditation Program.
But what will
learn all of that.
But, I mean, okay, you learn all of this, but there has to be a framework. I mean, what's it all for? Why learn all these things? What is the ultimate goal of the initiate, in a way?
Okay, well, the ultimate goal is really to fulfill your spiritual destiny. Every single person has a divine plan, as it were, within them. That is, the form that they are born to develop. So, for example, let's say a person is journeying through the Great Continuum, and one of the realms, the Great Continuum, is what we call the psychic realm. And as the soul journeys there might be certain abilities or certain gifts that it develops. And as it moves into the planetary initiations, you know, it may develop the gifts of ministry, or it may develop the form of a saint where it's able to send the Holy Spirit to other people. It might reach the state of an ascended master, where it's able to use the power of the spoken word, or into the third initiation, where it begins to minister through thought and to attune with the great hierarchy of light. So The objective of all this is to evolve consciously, to spiritually evolve. Not to evolve as a physical being, but to evolve spiritually, which means that you will actually awaken each of these, what we call the nodal points, which are the stable places where the soul dwells, through every level, all the way up to the place where the soul has its calling. So basically to fulfill that spiritual destiny is the purpose that we do that. And then we also talk about the higher octaves of development. So even after the soul is done with its planetary and what we call the transplanetary levels, there's additional evolution that goes on in what we call the cosmic, the supercosmic, and the transcendental realm.
Now, I mean, people have been doing this for a long, long time through many traditions, but do you find, like, this time now on the planet, it's something different is happening, or is it the same old story of soul evolution?
Well, what's happening now is that there has been more communication between, say, Eastern, Far Eastern and Middle Eastern sources and the Western sources. So the different religions are beginning to learn from one another. They're beginning to learn, people are beginning to learn about different paths. There are many people in the world who simply are born into a religion and that's all they know. But today with the internet and today especially in the more cosmopolitan cities where you have the exposure to many, many different teachings, people are learning about the many, many different paths that are available. And that is, in a sense, expanded people's ideas about what is possible.
But do you feel, and this is what I feel, I guess I should say, it seems like the spiritual realms are somehow closer. The veil between those dimensions are being lifted or thinned or refined. Is that true or is that a New Age myth?
Well, I think that for certain ones who are receptive to the light, there's a lot of light which is being poured into the world at this time. You know, the hierarchy of light, the great masters, our elder brothers, as we call them, they respond to humanity's evocation. And evocation consists of, you know, people's prayers, their yearning, their longing, their seeking greater light. So as people send these emotionalized thought forms into the ethers, the hierarchy responds and they respond to them as light. So you have to think that, you know, 3,000 years ago, we didn't have a billion people on the planet. Now we have seven times that many. So the amount of light which is pouring into the world is magnified many times over. So that's what we're feeling.
But do you
because
think
there are more people and there's more evocation.
But are we, and it feels this way to me, that we're reaching some kind of tipping point where the light will no longer be veiled from mainstream consciousness?
Well, every person has within them a certain, I want to call it a certain insulation, okay? This insulation is what psychologists call the unconscious mind, and the people in the East called it karma, okay? It's basically, it's a blanket of darkness. Now, the light is pouring into the world at all times, but like it says in the Bible, the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness comprehends it not. You know, so the light is coming in. The masters are ministering at all times, but people are insulated. They're not aware of the energy because of that insulation. Now, as people develop themselves, as they do spiritual techniques, as they develop inner visioning, as they begin to commune with inner guides, begin to, you know, actively seek to commune with these higher sources, then they begin to feel the light. But not everybody does that. I mean, it'd be nice if everybody did. We'd probably have a golden age.
Well, I think we're moving to a golden. I mean, more people are aware of this than ever before on the planet, like you said, and I think that is accessing even more of this level, and it's building to a new age, a new consciousness, an Aquarian age, let's call it, or whatever you want to call it, huh?
Or Well, again, as we look at the as we see the cycles of time, and the Hindus talked about this. They talked about the Satya Yuga, which is essentially the Golden Age, and then they called what they called the Treta Yuga, or the Silver Age, and then they talked about the Dwapara Yuga, which is the Bronze Age, and finally the Kali Yuga, which is the Iron Age. Now, if you think about this as a great cycle, then once humanity has reached through the Kali Yuga, which is really the darkest period when man is most material, and then we see man starting to ascend again, moving up through the ethers, through the finer ethers. And I feel what's happening now is that humanity has moved through the worst of the Kali Yuga, and we're beginning to reascend into what we call the Dwapara Yuga. So as we're doing that, we're becoming more aware of the subtle ethers. So, for example, at the grossest level, people are only aware of physical matter. And then as you become more sensitive, you become aware of the subatomic level. You move beyond that, and you move to the resonance ether. And most people are aware of that. Like if you go to a special place like Sedona, Arizona, or Mount Shasta, or the Grand Tetons in the United States, and there are many spiritual places around the world, people feel that energy. That's that resonance ether, where you actually feel the energy which is in these particular places. Then as we move further on that scale, as we move further up the cycle, we become aware of what's called the life force ether. And these are the people who are into healing, who understand how life force interfaces with what we call the etheric body. And people begin to get in touch with what we call the thought forms. This is the people who are into the law of attraction.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you become more and more subtle, you begin to go through different layers of the mind. And then ultimately, you rise to the state of consciousness where you're aware of your own spirit and your own soul. At that level, a person begins to operate independently as a spiritual being. So you can say that when a person has reached that state, you can say that they've begun to, you might say they moved into like the Silver Age, as it were. You know, they moved kind of through the Dwapara Yuga into the Silver Age. So, if we look at the life way of humanity as a whole, you know, we talk about directly above the subatomic level that our physicists have talked about, there's another layer that we call the information ether. And this is a level that we tap into with, like, the World Wide Web or the Internet. And beyond that is that resonance ether, in which holds all information and all space in the silence. So if you look at the life wave of the planet, right now we're moving through the upper levels of the information ether. So we come out of the darkest place in matter now. We're beginning to make our ascension, you know, as humanity. So that's the way that I see it.
No, I agree, and many people say a similar thing in a different way, but it's basically the same idea that there's this ascension wave. And so what does the world look like? How does humanity look in its interactions and its, you know, international relationship, in a way, with that kind of age that is coming? I mean, how does the planet change, I guess? I mean, not just the individual, but the planetary culture. Do we come into a oneness of understanding, or do we still have these divisions and religions?
What I see is that people become identified with a particular spiritual essence, and they tend to defend that spiritual essence very, very powerfully. And this is something that creates all of the different divisions in humanity, because people identify with different spiritual essences. So one of the things we talk about, for example, in the Judeo-Christian religion, people tend to identify with a spiritual essence that we call a nucleus of identity. Now, a nucleus of identity is something that's often mistaken for the soul, but really it's just like an integration center. It ties together many different faculties in one. And so that center that's sometimes called the Christ Child or the White Stone or the Philosopher's Stone, or sometimes it's called, we refer to it as the Moon Soul, is the nucleus of identity that they tend to identify with. The many of the groups that are led by the beings we call yogi preceptors, the yoga masters, they tend to identify with a higher nucleus of identity called cosmic consciousness. And other groups, like the Muslims, tend to identify with a seed atom that's on a particular super cosmic path. So when people are when people are identified with these different essences, then they view the world through that context. They don't have a way to be able to look from other contexts, and that's the reason why we have this lack of understanding and this, you know, the sense of everyone polarized against everybody else.
Right,
now, one of the practices,
their little piece, right?
And so one of the things that we teach in our meditation course, and I would like to see more people do this. I remember when Ram Dass first came here in the late 1960s, and he used to do this, and I, you know, it was something that I found was wonderful, was that, you know, we teach people, like when we teach chanting, we teach people to do different mantras and to feel the resonance and to kind of get a sense about what it's like from that other perspective. I mean, could you imagine what it'd be like if a Buddhist could really come and sit with a Christian and just really understand the way they're seeing the world and how they're holding it? And if a Christian could go up and be with a Buddhist in the heart mind, you know, so that we could really get it that, okay, we're all in the same continuum. We're just, you know, we're just identified with another essence.
Well, yeah, no, I think this is where we're coming to as a global consciousness, is that we are letting go of those old identifications, and we're moving into a global culture that will really shift the whole awareness of who we are as human beings and give us this kind of broader view that you're talking about. I just wanted to ask Shiloh, who studied with you, what some of his experiences were in your meditations and what happened to him, and how did you shift, Shiloh, in your work with George?
Well, when I came to George, I was, as he later told me, my soul was in what he calls the psychic realm, and I was having a lot of sort of tumultuous experiences, and I was looking for answers, and I remember I had found George's website, and he had quite a detailed description of, you know, the spiritual realms in a way that I had never seen before, and so I reached out to him. And he started instructing me on how to use this thing he calls the transformational mantra to basically kind of like boost my soul out of the spot that I was in. And kind of through that, I realized that, you know, there's like the physical realm, which is where you are physically, but where your soul is a, basically a completely independent thing. And so by practicing this meditation, I made a bunch of changes in my own life by unfolding these nodal points and allowing myself to kind of unfold. And what has resulted is a kind of change in focus of my life by the way the kind of like the content of my experience has shifted because of the transformation I've gone through.
So, George, is Shiloh's soul then in a next level of awakening?
Yeah, Shiloh has moved along the path. Now, what takes place as a person uses this transformational mantra is they draw down the light of the spirit, the divine light, which is called the Prakash of the Jyoti. And basically what it does, just like when you take a magnifying glass and you focus the rays of the sun, what it does is this mantra pulls down the light and it begins to burn that karma that dwells between where your soul is now and the next nodal point. And a nodal point is a stable place where your soul dwells. So if you can imagine like a flute. And you imagine there's this space between the two holes. Well, when you burn up the karma that's between those two holes, the soul moves to that next little hole. So it under, and that same process takes place at every level of its consciousness. And, you know, when you study the soul, you see the soul is a multidimensional being. It has many, many forms through which it's expressing. And as it continues to evolve on the path, it opens up yet new forms, which give it new abilities and new powers and new understanding.
But the amazing thing is, I think, because I've been tracking my own soul's progression and whatever way I can, is that when the soul enters a new realm, the perspective, the consciousness, the awareness of the planet moves to a new place. Would you say that happened with you, Shiloh? Your own perspective? Or no?
Well, I noticed that I move independently of the planet and other beings on the planet.
So like you're saying your consciousness shifted.
Oh, yeah, my consciousness shifts.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I mean, is that make sense? As your soul evolves, it seems like the awareness changes. I mean, is that true, George, or?
Yeah, well, again, when we say the soul evolves, what's taking place is that the soul moves forward on its own plane. And then each of the centers of its essential vehicle of consciousness are also tuned up. And then any of the other vehicles of consciousness that it has on any plane that's already opened also are tuned up. And then there are also centers in the, you know, what we call the metaconscious mind and the subconscious mind and the conscious mind, which are also tuned up in synchrony with the soul. So the soul moves and all vehicles move in synchrony with, you know, with its new state of evolution.
But so
and
you...
so awareness, now awareness is usually an attentional function. So when we say you change your awareness, it means that you're taking your attention and you're focusing it somewhere, and as you focus it and hold it there, your awareness will open. Now to bring about the state of enlightenment, you have to raise your attention to the level of the soul, and then you realize the nature of your soul. And this is a practice that, you know, is widely used. You know, we see it in the New Age movement. We see it among the Jnana Yogis and the Raja Yogis and many different traditions. We'll use that focusing power of the attention to awaken a spiritual essence within. So, awareness follows the attention.
Okay, so the nature, when you realize the nature of the soul, you realize you're eternal, and then that changes who your actions here on earth as a human being.
Yeah, and basically the way that I see it is that as you get in touch with your soul, you realize that, you know, you are not just the limited body-identified part of us, which people call the ego, and you're not just the personality, but there is a greater life within you. And so you begin to establish a cooperative relationship between the eternal and the self, and also to begin to work with, you know, guiding behavior so that you begin to enact behavior that's in line with what you may call the soul's expressed purpose.
So I wanted to ask you, when you're describing the unfolding of the soul, you described all these things unfolding kind of in synchrony with it. But I wanted, are there times when people's practices don't unfold at all in synchrony, or if people don't necessarily know what they're doing or how what they're doing is functioning?
What we find, now, one of our articles that we have on our website is called The Axis of Being. And what we've done is we basically traced each of the aspects of the soul through each of the higher worlds. And what we find is that what we call the cutting edge of spirituality, that aspect of the soul, which is essentially animated by the divine light and life, sort of like, if you will, the pointing finger of God that makes the soul to live. We look at what's lined up with that. We find that when you begin to work with the cutting edge of spirituality, so if your cutting edge is planetary, you work at that level, and you're not generally going to have problems. But what we see is that people begin awakening either a nucleus of identity or an ensouling entity, you know, a soul, an aspect of the soul which is in the higher octave, or a spiritual essence in a higher octave, and they develop themselves at that level outside of the cutting edge of spirituality. And what we see is that people begin to produce states of what we call imbalance. And when people become imbalanced, there are many things that happen. And we've traced this, you know, with great detail, studied it quite carefully. And what we find that at first, when people have these types of experiences, they're very blissful and ecstatic. We call it the spiritual honeymoon phase. Okay? Mm-hmm. So they first, you know, they first start to have these really good experiences. Then all of a sudden, they start to get to a point where they find that they start to phase in and out of normal consciousness. They start to space out, as we call it. They may have times when it's sort of like their thoughts stop and or they can't make decisions. And then as this process begins to continue, they start to have more and more of these lapses. And sometimes they will have an awakening of the kundalini, and the kundalini will remain raised. And so they can't bring themselves back down to their normal state of consciousness. And then as this process continues, they become identified at that higher state. So, for example, if a person is working on a supercosmic path, they eventually become identified with that seed atom of the path. And then, you know, as they continue the progress, I mean, ultimately they're going to gain a form of mastery at that level, but it's a form of mastery which essentially is not tied in with their soul purpose. So they're actually, you know, they're doing something else. It's sort of like, you know, you were meant to be a champion runner and you went into swimming. So
now, does that happen commonly? I mean, percentage of people are kind of on the track?
This is quite common. I mean, it's a common practice. Again, what you see in what we call the aspirant phase of spirituality is, and when people are seeking, you know, they're going to different teachers, they're going to lectures, they're getting initiated by different people. You find that they get initiated by many different teachers. I had a dear friend of mine who passed on in the 90s, and he had been initiated by something like 30 different teachers.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, you know, the only issue with that, and, you know, for the most part, people will do it for a little bit. They say this is interesting. They don't stay with it. So usually there's not much harm that happens. But you see certain ones that will practice these techniques for years, and they'll develop themselves quite highly along one of these paths, and the symptoms of imbalance begin to occur. And normally what happens is when that takes place is you often will have a sense that, you know, that the body and the and your life and your personality is unreal, and you know, it's like you're living in this state where the world is not real. There's, you know, the psychologists call that derealization and but depersonalization. So those are not
people,
you know,
mistake
good
that
to live in.
Do people mistake that for like an evolved state commonly?
They do believe these are the signs of spiritual advancement. You know, in other words, it's like a person is following a particular spiritual track. And, you know, they reach a state of illumination and enlightenment through that. And then they say, well, this is the path, and these are the things that happen to you. You know, at a certain stage, you know, you won't be able to move your body, and you'll just sit there. You'll go into what we call a somatic trance, okay? Mm-hmm. They say that is a normal part of the process. When you are in touch with your cutting edge, however, you don't go into somatic trance. You maintain a continuity, a connection with your personality, regardless of what level you are evolving through. So as you complete your planetary work, your transplanetary work, your cosmic work, you're doing it in synchrony with that force we call the Alaya, the divine will, the force of animation. And so when you do that, you don't break that connection. But when you see people going through these different types of states of imbalance, I mean, they're not doing it, you know, they're not doing it in any way that, you know, they're doing it to control people or what have you. They do it because this is what they've learned. I mean, people teach what they learn. People teach what they experience. So, and again, you know, there, you know, the valuable part of it is that certainly by doing these techniques, people gain, different abilities and powers. They bring out, great creativity inside themselves. They bring out great virtue. They gain great illumination and wisdom, and certainly burn up an aspect of their karma. So, you know, it's not an entirely negative thing, but, you know, we see that, the outcome of it is, certainly it's a mixed outcome.
I know what you're talking about, because I've seen it in different spiritual cults. I've seen it in religions and born agains, and I mean, not to judge anybody, but I see that people reach a level where they have attained a certain ability of spiritual awareness, and in a way they think they've reached the ultimate. I mean, that's not quite what you're saying, but I see it as a kind of limitation on the possibilities of everything that is available to people on the total path of evolution. I mean, people have called it halfway up the mountain. I mean, it's sort of what you're saying. I don't know if it's exactly the same thing, but it tends to happen in cults, I think, in a way, what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, the generally in a cult, what happens is that a person becomes completely identified with that altered state of consciousness, and they tend to live in that state of consciousness. So instead of a person relating as one person to another, they're relating as, you know, a nucleus of identity to another nucleus of identity. So they're living in that other state of consciousness, and they're looking from that perspective. And that is guiding their behavior. That is guiding their belief. That is guiding their values. So it's taking over their lives entirely. And because these are altered states of consciousness, they're highly suggestible, which means that whoever the leader is, you know, they're telling them, you know, this is the way the world is. And the disciples think, yes, oh, my Guru Dev, this is the way the world is. You know, and it's like, you know, if they have a genuine teacher who isn't a charlatan, you know, I mean, they're going to be sensitive to the suggestions they give to people. And, you know, when you look at a lot of the traditional spiritual groups, I mean, they give them suggestions, but they're not negative suggestions. You know, I think, they teach them to be virtuous, to be good people, to be loving and kind. And not every group in which this is taking place where they're being influenced by their teacher is necessarily bringing out negative functions in them. But yes, there are the charlatans. Yes, there are the cult leaders who exploit people.
So if there are all these paths, you know, and people are just kind of seeking, what's a sure, I mean, if people just seek intuitively, or, you know, do they get where they need to go, or is, you know, because most people don't know about what you're talking about, and I think there's this kind of prevailing attitude that, you know, people just go where they're attracted to, and that there's this sort of internal guidance that eventually gets people to the right place.
Well, I think part of it is plain old sales. You know, like if you listen to the teachings of a lot of different masters, you know, they'll say, this is the way to true happiness. This is the highest truth. You know, this is where you're going to gain all these powers. You know, when you open the heart chakra, everyone in the world will fall in love with you. You know, I mean, some of the claims that they make are, I mean, absolutely bonkers. But, you know, people are attracted to that, and so they want to find out what it is. Or they'll say something like, we're going to give you the true elixir of life. Give you the, you know, and you know, but, you know, this is the true elixir. So you want to find out what it is. So people go and get initiated. They try it out, and they have this spiritual honeymoon phase, you know, where every good thing is happening to them. And, But then later, you know, things start to change, and it's not quite so nice.
And then when it does change, they get trapped, and they get in the way. They form an allegiance to this, and they get invested in it, and then it's hard to get them out of it because there's an emotional investment. That's like, you know, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
How do you get people out of that? Because I heard you actually help people get out of cults, and how do you do that?
Well, essentially, there are really four ways that people leave a cult. And this comes from the work of a lot of the people who have actually done, you know, spent their academic and then professional careers, you know, their careers in counseling, working with these people. And what they find, there are basically four ways that people leave a cult. The first way is people get dissatisfied and they leave. They say that probably 75% of the people actually leave the cult do it that way. The second way they leave is they're kicked out of the cult. That's called a castaway. And the third way is that the teacher dies. They're essentially abandoned. And the fourth way is that they are basically taken out of the group, like somebody kidnapped. It used to be a thing called deprogramming. Do you remember that? Have you ever heard of that deprogramming?
Of course I have. I've been around with cults. I mean, Scientology, there was the Moonies had deprogrammers. Yeah, of course I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, well, but anyway, so they...
kidnapped, yeah.
Yeah, so they would actually take people and kidnap from the cults, and they got so much grief over this because, you know, you're not supposed to kidnap an adult. you know, maybe a child. I mean, the parents still have custody over them, but not an adult. So they were kidnapping adults and causing a lot of problems. You know, but essentially, there has to be something. Essentially, they have to see that there's something not right about it. You know, because if they have this complete insular worldview, that's, you know, where the group is all containing for them. At that point. It's very hard to get them out of it. But if they begin to see, you know, flaws in the leader or flaws in the doctrine, or they begin to see, well, they're promising me this and I'm not getting this, or, you know, I'm feeling really beat up after, you know, spending 16-hour days going out and trying to do convert other people to the path, I'm getting tired of this. You know, what about my life? You know, so when these doubts come up, you know, these are times that if they actually can act on that. And often in some of these groups, people have to actively, you know, and courageously leave because, you know, all the people around them say, no, we want you to stay. And sometimes it's dangerous because, you know, people will be hounded, you know, people will be called, they'll be stalked, threatened, you know, so it takes a lot of courage to leave some of these groups.
Right, but I was asking you sort of what is the kind of spiritual opening that maybe you can give people to realize that they've been in a cult and not in a true spiritual tradition? I mean, what can you say to people?
Well, again, I look at certain factors. Now, there's an article on my website. It's called The Boyd Cult Scale. And it's just www.mudraashram.com/cultscale.html.
Mm-hmm.
And in that article, I summarize some of the key factors that you see in cults. And generally, a rule of thumb I use is that if this group scores over 60%, it's probably a cult. So that's one of the things, and then the other thing is that, you know, people have to, you know, to leave a cult, a person has to come to the decision within themselves that it doesn't fit for them anymore. You cannot argue with a person and say, this is a cult. You know, you know, sometimes you can reach them, but usually not. In other words, it's got to come from them that they say, I want something better, this isn't working. There's something wrong here. This doesn't fit, you know. So they will leave it. And once they leave it, at that point, their job is that they've got to recover, because there's a lot of things that often take place. Now, for example, when you get in a cult, essentially you may stop doing all the things that you would have normally done. So you might have stopped college. You might have stopped, you know, working. You might have stopped, might have left your relationship. You might have left your family. And people have left you behind. So you have to basically rebuild your life. And then the second thing is you've got to deal with all of the emotional issues that come with, you know, the loss of the supernatural love object, or, you know, the loss of all your divine community. So there's a lot of issues that have to be worked out. And so what has to happen is that essentially a person has to, you know, work a structured program to work with each of these issues.
But also, I just want to say another distinction is I've been in organizations that some people could call cults, and the thing is, it's sort of up to the individual. I was in a particular one that I felt like I wasn't in it, but I could feel like people were taking the same classes and made it into a cult. And for me, I didn't feel like I was in a cult. I was getting a spiritual teaching, but I was different, let's say, because I was, maybe I didn't commit fully.
You didn't totally buy into it like they did.
Yeah, I did not. Exactly. I took what I could and left the rest. So that's sort of, but you can take great spiritual teachings, and there are some. I mean, I would say even in the formal religions, there's some great spiritual teachings, but you don't have to buy the whole religion. You know, so, I mean, I'd say religions are cults, and, you know, the churches, all that, they're their own kind of, the same formulas that you,
Yeah, religions can, depending on the way that they work with the attention of their followers, the way that they guide the attention of followers, they can turn their religious experience into a cultic one. You know, so it's not, you know, there are many mainstream religions that, you know, that don't do those practices, but there are others where, you know, they enter these altered states of consciousness and, you know, especially some of the more evangelical forms where people become identified with the spirit or, you know, the nucleus of identity within.
Yeah, no, I get that, and I appreciate that, and you know, I'd love for you to do a reading. I also want to talk about spiritual cartography, but what I'm also interested right now is your history. I mean, how did you come to have such a beautiful overview of the hierarchies of spiritual states and sort of a broad span of different spiritual traditions? Because it's somehow, I get the sense you integrated it all into a really smooth, even map of possibilities. So, what's your path? Well, how did it come to you? And a brief, you know, short years.
Well, my particular journey began in 1965. At that time, I started reading books on Theosophy and Buddhism in the Santa Monica Library. And I came across a book called The Fundamentals of Yoga by a gentleman by the name of Ramamurti Mishra. And he taught basically Ashtanga Yoga. And I studied that. I was doing Hatha Yoga every morning. I would get up and, you know, do my meditation every morning. I'd practice everything in that book. He later was given the spiritual name Swami Brahmananda. Mm-hmm. And while I never actually met him, I did, you know, I consider him certainly one of my mentors in a sense that I learned so much from him about meditation. Now, in 1969, I encountered my first teacher. Now, I had been wandering around in 67, I was up at the Summer of Love, and I was doing that. An
you
official
were
flower child. Yeah, I was loving at that time. Summer love. Okay, and I wandered around. I went to different communes. I went up to Portland, Oregon. I got born. I became a Pentecostal born again Christian when I was up in Oregon, and then I was guided to return to Los Angeles. And when I came back to Los Angeles, I came back, started college. But it's like, even though I was doing college, it's like I had this inner spiritual yearning, and I kept wanting to find a spiritual master, what I call the perfect master, a thought guru. This is my big yearning. And so one day in 1969, one of my friends called me up, and she said, oh, there's this man who gives the light. And she said, he paints these beautiful pictures of the great ascended masters, and Jesus, and Buddha, and Krishna. And, you know, I said, and I remembered the name. And I was looking in this bookstore, a very odd bookstore. Half of it was Americana, and the other half of it was New Age occult, goddess bookstore. Anyway, I went in there, and I saw this little picture that had this man's name on it. His name was Vicente Teresiani. He calls himself the Mahajini Teresiani. And my intuition told me, go and ask the man behind the counter where this man lives. You know, that didn't make any sense to me, but, you know, I did that. And he said, oh, yeah, he lives at such and such an address in Santa Monica, you know, which is about maybe a mile and a half away, not too far away. And so my intuition says, please go there right now. So I went and walked over there and walked up to this second-story building and, second up a flight of stairs to, like, this second floor. And, you know, I'm like, my mind is going like, oh, my goodness, you know, the guy's going to arrest me. He's going to think I'm completely nuts. And all of a sudden, I feel this energy coming through the door. I mean, like something is reading me at all levels of my being. And the door opens, and here's this man in an impeccable Nehru suit. You know, it's so silent in the house that it is hissing. And he looks at me, and his eyes twinkle. He says, oh, you've come for the light, haven't you? And he proceeds to hold his hands in the air and to just pour this light inside of me. I mean, I felt like someone was, you know, just absolutely blasting me with light. So I used to go to his meetings for about 6 months after this experience, and he opened me, you know, gave me powerful Kundalini experiences and basically opened me up into the what we call the cosmic realm and introduced me to that level of consciousness that I have since called the astral soul. Now, after that, I studied with him, and then he disappeared. He basically moved, you know, the spirit tells him, you know, it's time to move. So he moved, and he disappeared and didn't tell me where he went. So at that time, I was still looking for the Sat Guru. You know, I was looking for my Sat Guru that I had been seeking. And in 1971, I was with some friends of mine. I had studied another path called Ananda Marga, and I'd gotten a mantra, so I learned a little about using mantras with them. Fun little path, a lot of singing and chanting and doing the mantra. Anyway, I was with several of my, several of the students who were studying that path, and we were down on Venice Beach. At the time, they had just broken up one of the big amusement parks. It was called Pacific Ocean Park. And they'd broken it up, and there are all these planks. So we were down on the beach gathering up these planks. And all of a sudden, I see this poster of this little 8-year-old boy in a state of, like, absolute bliss. And at the bottom of the sign, it says, Satguru has come. You know, here I am looking for a Satguru, right? And the sign says, Satguru has come.
Right, right.
So, you know, I mean, that's really it piqued my interest. So I went to see him at this place called the Wilshire Ebell Theater. And in kind of the Crenshaw area of Los Angeles.
This is Guru Maharaji?
Guru Maharaji. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I met him when he first came to Los Angeles. And I got initiated by him up in a place right above the Hollywood Bowl called Alta Loma Terrace. And interestingly enough, I saw one of his books, recent books, that was published, written about him. And there's a picture of me in there. I got a kick out of that. actually at Alta Loma Terrace, but I was initiated there, and I had an extremely powerful experience with him. I mean, it just, it was going into a whole other world. And for about 5 years, I was not with the human race. I was completely absorbed in that. I mean, it was such a powerful experience. I mean, if you ever had the experience of driving in a really, really fast car, you know, it's like you've gone back into the seat. Well, it was like that. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, well, here I'm going to meditate. It was like I would get sucked into meditation, and I would just be completely absorbed for hours. At one point, I was meditating 8 to 10 hours a day during this period, during about a five-year period.
What kind of experiences were you having in that deep meditation?
If you could imagine just revelation of knowledge just pouring inside of you of all the different worlds, just opening up world after world after world. I mean, it was absolutely fascinating, and this essence inside of you would move into light, and then it would shift and would move into sound, and then it would move into nectar, and then it would move into what they call the holy name or the pranic vibration. I mean, it was absolutely compelling. I mean, it was like, it wasn't a matter of saying, well, you know, now I'm going to sit down and meditate. It was like, you know, I was just pulled, my attention was just pulled into the state of consciousness. In 1975, I had what I call a completion experience, that this essence in me just basically entered this great oceanic state. And at that point, that's where I marked the beginning of the beginning of this particular lineage. And at that state, what we call the root teacher of Mudra Ashram, began to develop a lineage of masters on a very, very high level of the continuum, on what's called the bridge path.
Are you saying Guru Maharaj's lineage started to develop this school of thinking?
That's where this started. It actually started from that experience, is where that, you know, that realization, and then out of that, you know, this became the root teacher of the Mudra Ashram lineage. So it's not
an inner teaching.
Yeah, it's an inner teaching. It's the arising of a new lineage, the building of a new lineage on the inner planes is essentially what was taking place.
But did you have etheric masters come to you and start to teach you about these levels in a way?
Well, let me tell you a little more on the story here.
Okay, sure.
Now after I completed that, I mean, after I had been through that experience, I mean, I was so, you know, at that point, I could hardly keep my feet on the ground. I mean, it was like so out there. I was like so imbalanced. I had to spend about 3 to 4 years just trying to come back down. And one of the things that helped me come back down is I used to dance. I used to dance a lot. Doing manual activities as well was very helpful. Dancing was probably the most important thing. It helped me get back in the body because it was like almost impossible because I get sucked up into that state of consciousness. So I had to actually kind of cling to, you know, my regular consciousness again. Now, I also got initiated slightly after that, because this was something that I had had a strong desire for, that I really wanted to meet a master of the Sant Mat. And I was initiating the Sant Mat in 1978, and I meditated for about 2.5 years with them, and I had a really beautiful experience, and I really was able to work on, you know, my ethical life, you know, to work on developing virtue, develop character and integrity, things like that, which is very important for me. Now, around 1980, I went back to college, went back to finish college at UCLA. I took psychology, and that helped me a lot because I was able to begin to rehabilitate, you know, those aspects of my mind that I essentially shut off for many years. So, you know, I'd learned to use my intellect and my reason again, and you know, that gave me kind of both perspectives. I was able to use the personality to understand things and also to go into the spiritual realms as well. Now, finally, I rounded this out, my spiritual training out, by taking Kriya Yoga with the Self-Realization Fellowship. Now, back in the late 1960s, probably around 68, 69, I had started the Self-Realization Fellowship lessons, but I had never taken Kriya Yoga. And so at that time, my intuition told me, you should finish this. You know, you started it, you should finish it. So what I did is I took the Kriya Yoga lessons, and I did the first two, and they were, you know, they seemed somehow familiar. They were not difficult. But when I got the third Kriya, it was very amazing. I had this experience, like this inner voice inside of me. It said, what day and time is it? And I said, well, it was, I believe this was like 1982. And this inner voice said to me, I have not done this technique since 1893. And then I realized that I had been a disciple. I'd actually been a disciple, a student of one of the teachers in the Yogananda's lineage, Lahiri Mahasaya. And so
you were Lahiri. Wait. You said you felt like you.
No,
were
I was
Lahiri?
One of his students. I was one of his students.
Because you sort of look like him a little. You do look like him a little bit. You know, Lahiri. I mean, there's a look. Anyway, that's just, you know, I could see something. That's a sort of energetic link there. But yeah. So you were a contemporary of Yukteswar. Then you were like on that same. Lineage as
there's a very interesting book. If you can get a hold of a copy of it, and certainly your listeners, if they can get a hold of a copy of it, which is one of the most remarkable books about the life of Lahiri Mahasaya. It's basically called Lahiri Mahasaya, and it's by a gentleman by the name of Swami Satyaswar Ananda. Mm-hmm. And he has a group in, I believe, in the San Diego area.
Right.
But that basically details all of the different Kriya Yoga lineages, plus it talks about who were all the disciples, the major disciples of Lahiri Mahasaya. And, I mean, they detailed, you know, each of these individuals and who they initiated, and, I mean, that's pretty amazing.
So your past life is mentioned in that book, who you were.
I'm not entirely sure. Now, he mentions, now I know that in that life, the thing that got in the way for me is I went out chasing after a dance hall girl, and interestingly enough, he mentions one of the disciples who had a interlude with a dance hall girl. So it's, I cannot absolutely confirm it, but it's very interesting.
That'll get you every time, those dance hall girls. But yeah,
that's right. Yes, they will.
But anyway.
Where this all comes together is that after doing Kriya Yoga, I started going through this period in which I would be visited by different teachers. Now, you're talking about the etheric masters. I was seeing visions of Jesus and Babaji coming to me in meditation, and they would teach me different things. And I saw this other teacher that was present with them. And he identified himself as Swami Prendayal. And he was connected with this newly emerging lineage. Mm-hmm. Well, at one point in 1983, as he began to teach me a little more intimately, in 1983, he basically told me, you know, sit down and write, and you're going to teach this class to the world. And he proceeded to dictate to me the fundamentals of this class that I've been teaching since 1983 called the Mudra Ashram Master Course in Meditation. I mean, he just gave it to me all there, just pouring this wisdom and knowledge through me and showing me.
Well, so he gave it to you as a telepathic download. You sort of just started writing what was coming to you. Is that it? Is that how it happened?
Well, actually, it was a telepathic download, but it was actually a state where I was in the state of meditation standing before him, just like, you know, you stand before a human being and talk with them. Well, I was on the higher planes looking at him eyeball to eyeball, and he was telling me this, and I'm writing it down as he's telling me it. So, you know, it's in full consciousness, you know, definitely knowing what the source of it was. And then at that time, he said that from, you know, and then he anointed me, and he said, from this day forward, you will be a channel of our light and our power, and you will be a channel of our wisdom and our guidance, and you will also be our mouthpiece. And at that time, you know, from that time forward, they have spoken through me, they channeled well. I've written now 14 books. Actually, I take that back, 15 books, working on number 16, just pouring this knowledge through. And three books of poetry included in that.
Is the knowledge then evolving with the times, or is it ancient knowledge? I'm just curious.
It's a knowledge that comes from a observation of this great continuum of consciousness. I wanted to say a little about that to kind of explain to your listeners what this great continuum of consciousness is. This great continuum of consciousness is all the different levels of the mind. Now, the first level of the mind is what we call the conscious mind. This is the part of our mind that's aware of our present time experience. You know, a lot of people learning techniques like Vipassana, where they get in touch with their present time, you know, physical experience, or their present time feelings, or their present time thoughts. This is the first band of the mind, when we're aware of what's going on right in this moment. Then the next band of the mind is what we call the subconscious mind, which includes our faculty of memory, the system of chakras that people talk about, which is a storehouse of memory and its interface between the higher aspects of our mind, between our soul and our personality, and also the faculty of the astral body, which is our faculty of imagination and visioning. Then there's our metaconscious mind, which is all the executive functions of our personality. These are things like our ability to make a long-term commitment, our ability to use social skills, our ability to establish values through our conscience, our ability to plan and to schedule, you know, using what we call the concrete mind, to use the abstract reasoning of the intellect, to be able to check in with ourselves, what we call personal intuition. And it's all coordinated by an aspect of our mind that we call the self. The self is the nucleus of our entire personality, which comprises these three minds. And the self interfaces with the entire personality, rules it, controls it, through the faculty of what we call the will or volition. Now, the highest aspect of the mind is what we call a superconscious mind. And there are different bands within this superconscious mind. So the first band, which is closest to the personality, we refer to as the subtle realm. And that's the realm of a lot of the mythic religions, you know, what are sometimes called the quote-unquote the pagan religion. A lot of the great mythic traditions of the East Indian and the Chinese and the Greco-Roman and other world traditions are all found on that subtle realm. Now, the next band, where a lot of humanity is today, is the planetary realm. And the planetary realm consists of basically four what you might call preparatory introductory stages of spiritual growth, which include what we call the biophysical universe, which is our awareness of the physical universe and you know, the laws of physical evolution, the laws of, you know, Darwinian or biological evolution, the changes of the Earth. And then there's the abstract mind, which is the realm in which we begin to use our mind to basically to impose our intention in reality. So we can do it through on the body-mind programming subplane. It's people will often express that through sports. There's the temple of science, the temple of art, temple of philosophy. There's the Akashic records, where you begin to work with all the material that you stored on your in your present life and all of your past lives that are recorded in this cycle of time, and begin to use the higher aspects of the of what we call the higher aspects of the universal mind, where you begin to align with the laws of the universe, you know, the law of prosperity, the law of love, to bring, you know, bring your life into harmony with those divine laws. Now, the next band is the psychic realm, and that's where a lot of the New Age teachings have come down from. you have phenomena there like the law of attraction, a lot of things like spiritualism are based there, a lot of the UFO groups, a lot of the channelers. I've written a book about that called The Psychic Realm, Finding Safe Passage Through the Worlds of Illusion. And I talk about some of the challenges of that particular realm because of the fact that there's a lot of distortion that is introduced at that level. And then we talk about the wisdom plane, which is the level in which the soul begins to look at all that's created and decide, you know, well, what is it that is really appropriate to my purpose and who I am, and begins to let go of the things that no longer fit. Then the soul undergoes the five planetary initiations, which respectively have to do with the opening of the heart center, the first initiation, the heart center of the planetary man. The second is the throat center. The third initiation is the third eye or the thalamic center. The fourth is the brain, and then the fifth is the awakening of the soul in its own plane above the top of the head, which is called the transcerebral center. Now, beyond that, there is what we call transplanetary evolution, which is the levels of development of a higher octave of being that we call the monad. And, you know, just like the soul goes through its cycle of evolution, the monad also goes through its cycle of evolution. And then there's the cosmic realm. And at that level, our ensouling entity is called the astral soul. And it goes through five initiations. In many ways, there's some parallels between the planetary and the cosmic. And then in the supercosmic realm, typically the process is that an individual will take this little seed atom and unite it with the overshadowing supercosmic soul, and becoming a, quote-unquote, a realized soul, and then ascending as a realized soul to the seat of power, which is called, we call it the seat of the guru, or the guru padam. And then finally, the development in the transplanetary realm. And there are basically eight paths that track across the transplanetary realm. And typically, people will develop themselves on one or more of those paths. So I was initiated in two of those paths. I was initiated into the seventh transcendental path when I studied with Guru Maharaji, and I was also initiated into the second transcendental path when I was when I studied with Sant Darshan Singh, my Sant Ma teacher.
So that's what you call the spectrum of consciousness? What do you call it?
I call it the Great Continuum of Consciousness.
Great Continuum. And so most people who aren't anywhere, or where are most people on planet Earth within that continuum? I mean, are they anywhere, even if they're unconscious to any spiritual tradition, are they still on?
No. Everyone has a spiritual essence. Everyone has, you know, what we call a divine spark, the soul. Now, a great deal of humanity dwells in the subtle realm. And in the East, they refer to the soul, we call it the soul spark. In the East, they refer to it as the Jivan Atma. It means that this is an aspect of nature which is really completely free. There's nothing to hold. The only thing that is a container for it are the particular cultural influences. But if that is, supplanted by, you know, people who are, you know, demagogues or what have you, I mean, you can convert people into becoming, you know, terrorists and fighting holy wars and all kinds of stuff. And we see that happening in the world today. Now, another group of people tend to colonize the planetary realm. So I would say that probably the bulk of humanity probably is between the first planetary initiation and the beginning of the subtle realm. And then as you go up further, just like a pyramid thins out at the top, you find progressively fewer and fewer people who are taking the higher initiation. They're rarer.
But maybe there's more of that. So when you do a soul reading, is that what you do? You see where someone is on that?
Yeah, on the continuum, that's correct.
But do you want to do one on me if we go to Skype? I mean, do you?
Sure.
I mean, because we still have time. And then I also, is that the same as spiritual cartography, or is that something different?
Well, let me tell you what spiritual cartography is. When I finished graduate school, I got a master's degree in clinical psychology. I went back to California State, Dominguez Hills, and I got my master's degree in clinical psychology. When I finished that, I began working on studying this great continuum of consciousness in a very, very detailed way, in such a way that we would actually look at each nodal point, each distinct change in consciousness, and describe it. And the culmination of that came together in 2006 when I published the Rudra Ashram Correspondence Course, which essentially is a mapping of every single level of consciousness going through every realm, through every world. Each of the supercosmic paths, we found 73 of them. Each of the transcendental paths, throughout the cosmic realm, we describe the general features of the transplanetary evolution. Every nodal point through the subtle and the planetary realms, and every center of awareness within the personality. So nothing like this has ever been done. It is an absolutely mind-boggling piece of work that the teachers of the Mudra Ashram lineage have brought through me to humanity. So it is, when I think about it,
major.
It's major.
It's a major piece of spiritual, it's a classic spiritual text. I mean, it's sort of like a textbook for the soul on planet Earth, you would say.
Yeah, well, it's very much, it basically details, all the different levels. I mean, it's an absolutely incredible piece of information that has been laid upon humanity. So I feel, very, very humble and very, very grateful to have been able to, to receive this and to write it down and to share it. And I make this available to anybody who's completed either one of my first courses, either the Mudra Ashram Master Course in Meditation or the Accelerated Meditation Program. I do insist that people have some grounding in our particular terminology and understanding of, transformation and integral meditation, so they begin to fathom this, because without it, it's sort of like, jumping off into deep water. you need a little preparation first.
I'm wondering, there's a lot of people channeling different material, and I think some of it is of different quality. And obviously, your work goes beyond most in its detail and coherency, I think, and probably most notably its lack of extreme predictions or anything of that nature. So I don't know if you can speak about the quality of channeling, or the indication that what you brought in from kind of an invisible source physically is of a degree that people should listen to.
Yeah, well, let me see if I can speak to that. Now, channeling there are basically two forms of channeling. One form of channeling is when you channel your own spiritual essence. You can channel your own attentional principle. You can channel your own spirit. You can channel your own soul. That's what they call in the East, speaking from the core of truth, or satsang. Okay? There's also a second form of channeling where you make a connection with either a spiritual guide or another spiritual entity, another spiritual being. You link up with them, and then they channel their knowledge through you. Okay? Now, where a lot of the New Age channeling comes from is simply tapping into sources on the psychic realm. Another group of channeling comes through from people who are in touch with this moon, solar, Christ child nucleus of identity, and when they are anointed with the Holy Spirit, typically sent through by a being that we call a saint, a person who's gained a mastery at that level, they will tend to give forth what they call prophecy. Another form of channeling you'll see is the channeling that comes down from the second initiation, which people activate a nucleus of identity that we call the solar angel. And you may have heard many people talk about the mighty I Am presence. Well, the mighty I Am presence is the heart center of this particular vehicle. And when you actually go up and look at it, it actually looks like an angel. Okay, it looks like an angel. I mean, it actually has wings, and the wings beat, you know, to cosmic rhythm, and it is actually, you know, an angelic form within you. And so people will tap into that, and they come forth with what are called decrees, or the word of power, when this speaks on your behalf. So these are probably the three most common forms of channeling that you see. Now, there's another form of channeling that in the East is called Gurumukh. Gurumukh. It means someone who has surrendered, who has become freed and surrendered to the Guru. Mm-hmm. Gurumukh. And when that takes place, is that basically a teacher will channel their wisdom and they actually channel their speech through you. But again, it's not like, you know, you're not like open mic to the spiritual plane. You know who you're channeling and you know what the source is. So the source of, you know, when I bring through these materials, I'm bringing it through from known entities on the bridge path, you know, which is a very, very high level in the transcendental realms. It's not, you know, I'm not drawing it from the psychic realm. I'm not getting it, you know, it's not coming to me as, you know, the gift of the Holy Spirit, or I'm not channeling that. Now, there is some channeling that does take place at higher levels. Occasionally you'll see messages coming through at the third initiation, which typically are telepathic channeling. Now, a lot of the work that in Theosophy, a lot of that work came through that was channeled information.
Madame Blavatsky's work. Blavatsky's sort of a channel that?
Yeah, but it's a different form of channeling. She didn't speak it. It was something that she received telepathically, and then she wrote it down. So it's kind of a different order. The only person I know that seems to be, and Alice Bailey also was tapping into that stream as well. But it's a different order. Typically, people will not speak that information. The only individual I believe that is actually speaking that information is a guy by the name of Ben Krim, and I'm not real sure.
Really? I don't know about Benjamin Krim. I don't think he...
You know, a lot of it seems pretty psychic, but a lot of the material that, you know, at least the content of what he's talking about seems to suggest at least he's had some contact with the ethers on the third initiation. So again,
I didn't really get much of a thing from Benjamin Krim. I thought he was not that original in his information, but that's just my opinion and judgment. So anyway.
But in terms Benjamin of, you know, I'm Krim, just, you know, but my take on this is just simply, you know, where are these people coming from when they're doing the channeling? So
I ask you about some channels, but yeah. Okay, I get it. So
the thing is that when you have a very, very high order type of the channeling, essentially an individual is usually from the third initiation and beyond, people rarely will channel another being. I mean, it does happen. Occasionally you do get channeling that does take place. That's in the state of a person who's a guru. So when I do my twice a month, I give what is called a light sitting. Shiloh comes to these on occasion, where at the end of our sitting, where we basically send the light to those present, and then we do a ministry where we send the light out to the world. At the end of the session, typically there is some satsang where the masters will speak. The masters will speak through me, and they, you know, give an inspirational message.
I see. Well, that seems to be happening more and more. There's a lot of people who, and I've met some great masters who are being channeled, I feel, from that realm that's not not the higher self, not the I am, not the angelic, but truly masters that want to speak to people on this dimension. And those are the ones that I enjoy and feel the most resonance with. So
is it possible for these beings to incarnate? I mean, these high beings, do they need to rely on a channel, or is it impossible for them to incarnate on this planet?
Well, actually, when you talk about a master, my first teacher was an incarnate cosmic master, which is extremely rare.
This was Mahajan.
It does happen, and there, sometimes these beings are an incarnation, but they tend to be, they tend to be rather secluded. I mean, they don't go out and, basically say, hi, how are you? I'm a Maha Chohan, and it's nice to meet you today. They don't come out like that. They tend to work in solitude. They work, they work with their students, their disciples, the ones they're working with. But they don't take a public stance per se. They tend to be pretty secluded. Very few people knew about my first teacher.
But isn't it the destiny of all human beings, all souls, to evolve to that level of mastery at some point in
absolutely
time?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. And that's where we are now at this level of evolution. So anyway, thanks for that overview. Now, if you were going to do a soul reading on me, we can stay on the phone. But if you want to look at me, you said.
Yeah, I do need to see you because I need to tune in. I need to tune into your soul.
I'm just going to connect with us on Skype, and we'll continue talking on the phone. And then from there, we'll also talk about the spiritual cartography as well.
Yeah.
Okay, that's me coming up on Skype. And
there you are.
Can you see me now?
I do. Hi, Alan.
Okay.
Hey, hang on a second. I just need to tune into here real quick.
Okay,
1, 2, 3. 4, 5. Okay. Alan, you are undergoing the third initiation. Okay, you are currently... Let's see. Let's turn this down. Third initiation. Verify that. Okay, there we go. 2, 3. Okay, you are in a subplane that we call the plane of New World Servers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you are at the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You're at the 7th nodal point of the plane of New World Servers. And this particular nodal point has to do with the integration of your personality with the soul. Okay, your soul is on the 1, 2. Okay, your soul is on the 7th ray. And let's see, let's check the personality here real quick. Okay, you have a second ray self, second ray personality. You have a third ray mind. I'll tell you what all these mean in a second.
Okay.
You have second ray emotions. And you have a 7th ray physical etheric. Okay. Now, the personality ray is kind of the way that you express in the world. And this makes you a born teacher, counselor, communicator. The third ray mind has to do with which aspect of the mind is dominant, and that indicates that your intellect is highly developed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the second ray emotions means that your persona is your dominant emotional expression, which means you're good using your social skills with other people. And the 7th ray physical etheric simply means that you are in alignment with the soul. You're not aligned to the collective, you're aligned to your soul. And the fact that you share the soul ray with the you share the soul ray with the physical etheric, which means that you are very much most alive when you are expressing your soul, when you are following the guidance of your soul, when you are becoming an instrument or channel for your soul. Now, the fact that you're on the seventh ray means that you have a powerful ability to synthesize and to bring things together. And the fact that you're taking the third initiation means that you have developed discernment. You've begun to get some detachment from all the emotional glamour. So you have a little more perspective on it than other people. So that's what your soul tells me about you. I mean,
Well, thank you. That feels right. It does really feel like a good reading. But then what do I do? How do I get to the next level, or how do I integrate more of who I am with what you can offer?
Well, again, if a person, I ask people to, look over our materials, perhaps read some of our books, and to see if it, see if our teaching resonates for them. If this does resonate for them, then essentially we will, give you the training either in the form of the, the in-person class, if you're able to be with me, or the by-mail class, which is the way that Shiloh took the course with me. I have a lot of students, actually all over the world now, students in China and India and Netherlands and England taking this course. I have one in South Africa.
What will it do for me to take these courses? How will I shift to something else?
Well, essentially, when you take the course, one of the keys that we give you is we give you the transformational mantra, which is key to your cutting edge. And so when we do that, it brings down the light and it allows you to essentially move to the next nodal point upon the path. And so you determine the rate at which you're going to basically push this process of spiritual evolution. Generally we say you don't want to, you don't want to speedboat across, because one of the important things is if you go to a new state, you want to take some time to integrate your experience.
Right.
You want to be able to gain something from this new expansion of consciousness.
Right.
So, people, generally we say, between 1 and 4 nodal points a day is a usual practice schedule. Some people may want to, take that a little bit slower. Some people may want to just move a little bit beyond that.
What's a nodal? How do I get to a different nodal point with a mantra, or what would it get me from this?
Okay. The way this works is that when you use your transformational mantra, and we teach you how to activate this mantra, is it draws down the light. Draws down the light of the spirit. Like I used the analogy before of a magnifying glass, focusing the rays of the sun. And what it does is it burns up the karma between one nodal point and the next. So imagine that, that just like, you look at the Grand Canyon, there are all these layers in there. So you're burning like layer by layer of the karma until you burn through to the next nodal point, and then your soul is free to move along to that next nodal point. So that's how the process occurs. And so what happens is you undergo an expansion of consciousness, or what they call in the Western work, they say you undergo initiation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So can you talk about the scale of nodal points, like if one is not meditating, or if one is meditating different practices, or how?
Now if a person simply, he really does, most people will do some type of religious activity or spiritual activity, and they'll invoke the higher power in some way. They live a good life. Now if a person does that, if you do no type of transformation, typically over, it's about an 11-12 year cycle. It's just like you see the sunspots come up about every 11-12 years on the sun. Well, every 11 or 12 years, an individual basically wears through, just by the process of living, they wear through this karma and they move to one nodal point. So typically people move between 3 and 12 nodal points in one lifetime. Now, if they do a lot of inner work, they do a lot of processing, a lot of prayer, they do, they get psychotherapy, they're working on themselves very intensively. You can see that range up to about 24. But if you have the keys to the actual living fire of the spirit, then, you know, you're really looking at unlimited. I mean, I had some students that basically did this process. They've been studying, like, well, over 20 years with me. But they basically have moved their cutting edge all the way from planetary to transplanetary to cosmic to supercosmic, all the way up into the transcendental. So it can be done, but again, you know, you have to have that strong determination to say that that's what I want. I want to make my ascension to master it. You know, a lot of people don't do that. A lot of people say, well, this has been nice, been an interesting experience. Let me see what else I can find. You know.
So, well, there is nothing else to find, though, really, is there? When you are aware of the ascension to mastery, what else would you want?
Well, you know, some people want a Porsche.
What, dance hall girls?
Okay, I guess that's true, but once you get seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all things will be delivered unto you, right?
Okay. Yeah, and again, you know, the other issue is that, you know, as you begin to ascend in spirituality, you know, you begin to let go of the other things. You know, you've experienced them. You know, you probably
right.
You've done all this stuff. So it's, you know, you don't have
right.
to do it anymore. I mean, maybe there's no excitement for you to have the Porsche, but for somebody, you know, that's the goal of their life. They save all
yeah.
their money, and they've got to have the Porsche. You know,
right.
But, you know, when you become more mature by the time you've taken the third initiation, you know, you really let go of all those things. So, you know, that's not important. You want to ascend and fulfill your full potential.
So what is spiritual cartography then? Is that what you just did, or is
okay.
that something else?
Okay, spiritual cartography means that you are mapping the domains of consciousness. So,
okay.
So again, there are different ways that we can interface with consciousness. So we can look at, you know, what's the content of this particular level. You know, we can make suggestions, maybe use its ability. You know, we can paint it or draw it or express it in some way. What cartography does is essentially you are studying and you're finding where that particular level of consciousness is on a scale relative to the entire map. And one of the things that we did in the correspondence course is we created a coordinate system so that you can actually identify each particular level of consciousness on this coordinate.
So where would I be? Could you give me a quick spiritual, would it help people? What does it do for people? And can you help me?
Okay. Well, again, knowing where you are, knowing what your cutting edge of spirituality is, you know, is very important because it gives you a clue as to, you know, where is the appropriate place for me to do my spiritual work. Because, again, a person can, you know, do meditations that transform them in the subtle realm. They can do meditations that will open centers of consciousness and nuclei of identity in the planetary realm. There are meditations that they can awaken aspects of consciousness in the cosmic, in the supercosmic, in the transcendental. So knowing the cutting edge is a very, very important part of this process. So once you know what that is and you say, well, this is where I need to start my work, this is where the divine light of the Elia is shining in me. And so that's where you begin your process of meditation.
Well,
now,
did you just... Go ahead. I mean, because you just did that for me, right? Or is that something else?
Yeah, we've just identified your cutting edge of spirituality.
Right. Okay. So then what do I need? I guess I can take a course, but is there something you can just say right now that would orientate me to the next level or something?
Okay. Well, typically what I would say, at this level of development, the teachings that are geared to, you know, where you are now are teachings like Theosophy, Alice Bailey, and I like very much the teachings of a group called the Meditation Group for the New Age. They're in Ojai. They make it very simple and very clear. These are the types of material that, you know, your soul, because you're now working in what's called the monastic plane, these are the teachings that are, you know, that have been anchored on the monastic plane, and they're, you know, they would be useful for you to study at this time. Now, the
Gnostic,
Monastic, M-A-N-A-S-I-C.
Monastic. Okay, the other thing, yeah.
And so these are the teachings that are anchored at this particular level. And these are and the, at this level, as your soul continues to evolve, as you move up to, I believe, somewhere between the 8th and the 8th and 10th nodal point, you begin to develop a direct connection between what we call the nucleus of identity on this level, which we call the monastic vortex, and the soul. And then you build another channel up to the monad, and then you will build another channel up to the master who is overshadowing your spiritual evolution. Now, when that takes place, then at that point, I mean, the master may or may not choose to, you know, make a contact with you, but in certain cases that does happen. So when, for example, Madame Blavatsky had opened up that level, the master DK came and made that attunement, so she was able to actually commune with him.
Well, I feel I'm in touch with, like, the Saint Germain aspects of, you know, that level,
Yeah, well, again, since you are in the seventh ray, now, Saint Germain is the highest initiate on the seventh ray, what we call the Chohan of the seventh ray. And all of the other masters that are currently working in the hierarchy under the seventh ray are under his aegis. So he tends to, you know, since there are not a lot of masters who are on the seventh ray, you know, it may very well be possible that you may be getting his impress. And that would be entirely appropriate because you are a seventh ray.
Right. Now, what about the people who are listening? I mean, how do they, I mean, they could do your course, but, I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, that don't have the availability of a specific connection with you or just listening now. What can you do for people just tuning in?
Okay. Well, again, if anybody is interested in learning about our course, they can go to our website, www.mudraashram.com, that's spelled MUDRASHRAM.com. It's like the word mudra and ashram, but there's only one A.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so
there's a lot of material on that. Now, anyone can, if they're interested in attending, say, our webinars, we have public, pre-public webinars that we teach. We also have some paid webinars, which are more like workshops online. We also have a light sitting. If anybody is interested in, you know, in learning about what we do and, you know, connecting with us, anyone can email me at george@mudraashram.com.
Can you explain
let me know of their interest. I mean, I can, you know, I can also guide people in terms of specific articles to read on the site. On my website, there's something on the order of probably about 150 different articles on all different topics. So you can go on the website and you can, you pretty much can feast because I rave on about all kind of stuff. I've got articles on transpersonal psychology. I've got articles on cults. I've got articles on all different forms of meditation. I've got articles for seekers. I have articles on the very advanced aspects of meditation. I have articles on practical meditation, recovering from addictions. So there are many articles out there. But again, if people are interested and they don't have access to Southern California for a 6-week period, I often recommend that people take the accelerated meditation program. And
okay, great.
Can you speak about the function and the effect of the light sitting that you do?
Okay, light sitting, yes. Okay. Well, now one of the things that a master teacher does is that from time to time they send through the light of the spirit, the divine light of the spirit, to basically to awaken the soul, to purify it, to balance it, to teach it inwardly, to reveal its inner nature. And they do this through sending out the light, through what we call an attunement. Now, this attunement is, you know, not, it, you don't have to be in the room with me. I mean, it's literally people feel this energy all over the world. I have people who tune in from China and India, and they say, I feel like I'm sitting in the room with you. So it's, you know, it's not, it's a non-local phenomenon. It's a non-local energy. And again, what takes place is that for some individuals are actually given initiation in the sense that the light will actually move them forward. Let's say that a person has opened up, you know, they've opened up a nodal point, and maybe they've opened up, you know, just part of the way. They haven't purified the whole distance. Well, sometimes the light will come and open up the rest of the way, so they're now balanced in the next nodal point. So sometimes it can grant initiation. And other times it may illumine a person. Another time it may give them the inner strength and guidance they need to deal with some personal problem that they're having. So the light ministers to each person in an individualized and a custom way. You know, if a person speaks another language, the light will come and teach them in whatever language that they're, you know, they speak. You know, the spirit speaks all languages. So again, this is the, you know, this is the way that all of the master teachers teach. You know, they don't, you know, they don't necessarily get up and, you know, get up and work on a blackboard, but they teach through light. They send out their waves of love and thought, and, you know, divine thought that's empowered by the spirit. And that's the thing that actually awakens. That awakens of it. And to the degree that people are receptive to this, you know, they can have quite a powerful experience.
Uh-huh. So the only way to have a powerful experience, though, is to just kind of start to tune into those levels of meditation, right, to open up our minds to new realities, to new possibilities.
Well, by all means, because essentially, you know, many people don't really move beyond the zone of their conscious mind. So they really are leaving, you know, three-quarters of their potential dormant. And
right.
So, you know, as you meditate, and then meditation is the process of moving your attention, you know, from your normal waking state of consciousness through these different inner vehicles of consciousness or levels of consciousness up to, you know, the level of your attentional principle to your spirit and to your soul.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think really if you're going inward like that, it's the beginning of everyone's spiritual journey, obviously. And then occasionally now, though, I think people are being, like, surprised by the potential of their mind. It seems to be activated for no reason at all, though, as well.
Yeah. Well, again, if a person has never really had an encounter with their superconscious mind, and, you know, discovering inside themselves the divine spark, you know, which we call the higher self of the soul, you know, I mean, it's a pretty amazing experience. But, you know, after you've done it for, you know, you've been up there for 10 years, it's really no big deal. But when you first encounter it, it's like, wow. But, you know, you know, so it's a great expansion, but then, you know, that becomes the new normal for you. You know, you say, well, okay, this is the higher self, that's nice, and there's a higher self, and everyone has a divine spark, and that's nice. And
would you say have you reached the level where you've attained, or are you still on your own journey?
Well, at this point, my meditations are for service. All the meditations that I do, and I tend to do a lot of my work on the bridge path, my meditations are for service. You know, and working with the masters, and so I'm not really, you know, you know, it's like when you journey through the whole continuum and you pretty much visited all the different realms, there's not a whole lot that you're searching for, but, you know, you want to help others. So that's kind of, you know, the meditations that we focus on at this time.
Okay.
this
That's sort of a bodhisattva, the bodhisattva role of... And so anything else you'd like to cover, I mean, before we wrap up, any questions from you over there, Sarah? Because I think we covered a lot of ground, and I really got an understanding of your, you know, overall approach, and the it's great to have a map of what you've created, or what lies in the realm of consciousness there. So, did you have a question?
Well, you know, the main thing that I would encourage people, if they're interested in the Mudra Ashram teachings, would be to come to our website. We are in the process of upgrading it. It is. I remember one person wrote me and said, I love your website. It's a little like an Easter egg hunt. But I want to let you know that if you persist, and you're going to find a lot of treasures there, because there are some wonderful, wonderful articles there. And again, if you're interested in any of our courses, please contact me, and I'll be happy to assist you. The other thing I did want to mention that is, that a lot of people don't know about me, but it is a service I've been doing since 2006. Is there a lot of individuals who have practiced meditation and they run into problems with their meditation because they've created these imbalances and their kundalini has become fixed with it. Either that or it's dredging up material from this area of darkness, which we call the unconscious mind. And they're experiencing something called Kundalini Emergency Syndrome. And I've been working with literally, you know, several hundred people over this period and helping them. And I do, and this is a service that I do as a service to the meditation community. People may make a donation if they wish, if they don't have the funds or whatever. I mean, we don't, you know, there's no set charge for it. If people want to contribute to the work, they can. But this is something I've been doing. So if you or any of your friends are having problems where you're having, you know, heat in your spine and great pains, or you can't function properly, or you're always in an altered state of consciousness and you're having problems, by all means write me and, you know, we can see if the kundalini is playing a role, because I do a reading to determine the state of whether the kundalini is aroused and whether or not it's playing a role in the symptoms that you are experiencing.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. But do you have like a gem you want to just leave the audience with so they can like get to the website? Do you have like a, you know, just some kind of thing you want to just overall philosophy you want to just
Okay. Well, I guess what I would say in a nutshell is that if you have the key to unlock this potential within yourself, there really are no limits to the potential spiritual growth that you can do. And when you work at your cutting edge, there are no cul-de-sacs. You don't get stuck at the, you know, at the level of the yogi preceptor. You don't get stuck at the top of the cosmic realm, or you don't get stuck at the top of a super cosmic path, or you don't get stuck at the highest plane into transcendental path. You simply go straight through all the different realms, and there are no barriers. Through the grace of the Mudra Ashram teachers, you know, we have that key. We can get that for you, so if any of you are interested, you know, we can give you that. But not just that alone, but to give you the whole, your whole toolbox of methods, how to awaken your spiritual heart, how to awaken your attentional principle and travel in full consciousness on the inner, to the inner realms, how to use your mind in a full and a complete way. You know, really the whole training, so you have all the tools that you need, both to work with your, you know, in your human life. Because in this particular tradition, we do not abandon your personality. You know, you need to be a whole person and a whole soul. You know, it's not either or, it's both. And so
it starts with the tool, like a mantra. The mantra is the key.
The transformational mantra. Okay, there are three key techniques that are core to this integral meditation system. The first is the transformational mantra, which unfolds the potentials of the soul. The second is Nadi Yoga, which is awakening the spiritual heart. And beginning to, and so we always develop that to the same level as the soul. So we say we unite the heart and the head. And then the third thing that we do is we awaken the attentional principle, sometimes called the third eye or the inner consciousness, the purusha, and we train that to travel in full consciousness. So you can go up and actually unite with the soul and then witness all the changes that take place. And also that's the level through which we begin to commune with the masters within, so that we can begin to become a disciple, where we begin to learn to minister on behalf of humanity.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, that's very exciting. I mean, I think just those three basic things can really get people going on a path that will show results, show evolution, you know. And thank you for, you know, committing your professional career to that, and, you know, your whole life is really committed to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, again, you know, I feel this is, you know, this is really my life's work, and I worked for 16 years as an academic and vocational counselor, and I was able to save up a little money, and so now for the last little over 2 years now, I've been basically doing this full time, and I started out with 6 books, and now I'm working on number 16, mm-hmm. and been doing webinars every week, and doing light sittings mm-hmm. twice a month, and corresponding with people all over the world, and I'll tell you, it's very fulfilling to me to be able to do this.
Well, thank you for being a guest here on New Realities. Any final words from you, Chuck?
Yeah, thank you, George. It's always wonderful to hear your perspective, and the more I learn, the more interested I am. So thank
yes.
you.
Well, I want to thank you for inviting me, Alan, and I want to thank you for connecting me with Alan Shiloh.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay, this will be posted on the bbsradio.website. I'll also post it on my website, and I'll send you links so you can, people want to find out more about you, they could listen to this program.
Great.
So I'll send you that. I've been talking to George Boyd of the Mudra Ashram. That's MudraAshram.com. Mudra Ashram Institute of Spiritual Studies in California, but also everywhere on the internet. Thank you, George, very much.
Thank you,
Alan.
This is Alan Steinfeld, and co-hosting here with Shiloh Jackson tonight's program. Any comments about the program?
Thank you. Very good. Yeah.
Okay. And if you want to reach me, you can go to newrealities.com. You can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net, and I welcome your comments and ideas and suggestions, so feel free. And thank you, Doug and Don at BBS Radio for producing and caretaking the airwaves for knowledge. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, Doug. Oh, my God.